All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Yes, and welcome everybody to another edition of Veterans Radio. I'm Bob Gould, your host for today, coming to you live at Talk Radio 1600 in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. If I sound full, it's because I know I got a cold or something. But anyway, we'll get through this. And we have a whole hour of live, that's right, live military information and stories and things that we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about Father Emil Capone. We're also going to be talking about the Great Lakes Cemetery. Ooh, how do you get in there? Well, first you got to die, right? No, it's a joke, right? Okay, well, we'll have something for that. And at the last segment, we're going to have someone from the Freedom Center, which is over in Metropolitan Airport. But there's many of them, and we're going to be talking about that. Okay, so what do? We get right into Scott Carter. Scott Carter is on the line right now. He was born and raised in Wichita. Yeah, that's how you say that, folks. I was there in the Army, Fort Riley, Kansas, and I got around. He first learned of Father Emil Capone while he was a senior in high school and was very impressed by the dedication and service from the priest. After college, he spent 3 years as director of our daily mass food pantry for Catholic Charities in Wichita, and he's been working at coordinator for the Father Capone Guild in Wichita for the past 2.5 years. Welcome to Veterans Radio, Scott.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
How are things in Kansas?
Pretty good. The sun is shining, so that's always nice.
Oh, good. We'll send you some snowflakes. They're coming our way. Okay.
You can keep them. That's okay.
Father Capone. Father, yeah. We've had a number of stories in the 15 years we've been on the air on Father Capone. So this, in fact, I think it's been about 2 years, 3 years since we had our last story. He was a priest who was captured in Korea right at the very beginning. So it was pretty tough back then. The Chinese came across the 38th parallel and raised all kinds of havoc there. He was captured and he became known as a servant of God while he served. He died in captivity in Korea. So that's a little bit about his story. Scott, tell us about where Father Capone came from.
Well, Father Capone grew up in a small town called Pilsen, Kansas. It was a farming community, and life really centered around, you know, farming and the Catholic Church. He was a son of Bohemian immigrants, and so spoke a little bit of Bohemian, which is now part of the Czech Republic. He spoke a little bit of German as well, but initially wanted to be a missionary and ended up becoming just a diocesan priest, so the priest for the Diocese of Wichita. But I think he kind of found his outlet, his missionary zeal, was able to... It found a good fit in the Army as a chaplain, and I think he really enjoyed, you know, serving the boys, his boys, as he called them, both in World War II and in Korea.
He was such a special person. He impressed his feelings, his goodness on everybody that he met. There's one story that I want to pass on very quickly. While he was in captivity, and it was Christmas time, they had a Jewish guy, and of course they had others, but they had a Jewish guy in the hut with them, and he made a cross. Now, how about that? A Jewish person making a Christian cross, but they needed it for their ceremonies, for their for the Christmas pageants or whatever they have there. And,
I don't know. Jerry,
whatever.
Jerry Fink, who carved the cross, he actually never met Father Capone. He actually was inspired. Father Capone had inspired the other men so much that when Jerry was sent to the camp, he asked, "What the heck is going on? This place is so much different. Everybody's looking out for each other and sharing food and washing each other's clothes And they said, well, it was because of our chaplain, Father Capon. And so he just heard about him secondhand, but was still inspired enough to make the crucifix in his honor.
He was called a soldier's chaplain, the most decorated chaplain in U.S. military history. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's kind of telling in his first letter, when he was first requesting the chaplaincy, he had initially been sent back to his home church, his home parish of Pilsen. And, you know, a small town, he kind of felt like he wasn't doing as much good as he could have been just because people knew him. But he wrote to the bishop. He said, when I was ordained a priest, I wanted to spend myself for God and other people. And he said, I wanted to do that joyfully, no matter, you know, what the circumstance. And he was able to do that, you know, in very difficult circumstances. And he didn't let something like a battle stop him from serving others. He was out there on the front lines, you know, hopping from foxhole to foxhole while bullets are flying over his head. One time he actually had his pipe shot out of his mouth. And there's a picture of him holding it up afterwards, and he's got the biggest grin on his face that I've seen in any of the pictures of him. So I think he really, you know, was just loved living the same army life as all of his men.
He was given the title Servant of God in 1993. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Servant of God is the first step along a long path to being officially named a saint in the Catholic Church. So people, you know, immediately after his death and after the prisoners were released, they started telling stories to the rest of the world about their heroic chaplain. And it took a number of years, but eventually the Archdiocese of the Military said, hey, we want to investigate this guy for sainthood. And they didn't have really the resources at the time to continue on, so the Diocese of Wichita picked it up. We're currently in the process. We've collected a whole bunch of information, 8,000 pages worth of, you know, interviews of people who knew him, a lot of anything that he wrote that we could get our hands on, including letters and his sermons, had a whole bunch of like class notes and all that sort of stuff. And we sent it over to Rome. And so the next step after Servant of God, he would be named Venerable, which means basically that worthy of, you know, honor, recognizing that he lived a heroic life of virtue. And so we're currently waiting on that step. We turned in sort of the summary of those 8,000 pages is a 1,000-page book, which is quite the summary. We turned that in a couple years ago, and Rome is looking at it. They're also working on, you know, other cases from around the world as well. But Rome is working on that, and we're hoping maybe within the next year that he'll be named Venerable. And then at that point, that's when they can start looking at miracles that are needed, first for his beatification, and then a second one will be needed for being named a saint. So it's something that we think, you know, a saint is someone who is in heaven, so we think he's there already, but it takes time for the official process to go through.
What was the most memorable story? I know there's so many of them, but can you pick out one that you can tell us about?
Sure. I mean, you're right. It is hard. I was able to talk to William Funches. He was a lieutenant from Clemson, South Carolina. And he was actually in an infantry division, and Father Capon was in the 1st Cavalry Division. But they both ended up in the same prison camp. And the North Koreans didn't treat the prisoners well. They actually didn't give them any water at all. They were forced to eat snow on the side of the road. And it had been several months, I think four months maybe, since they had been captured. And Lieutenant Funches said that he saw this guy kind of bent over this makeshift fire and doing all sorts of crazy things, and he kind of looked like a scarecrow. And he said he was a little bit scared, and he kind of decided he was just going to pass on without saying anything when the figure waved him over. And as he got closer, he could see that he was melting snow for warm water, and he offered Funches a cup of water and introduced himself as Chaplain Capon. And Funches said that that was the first drink of water he had had for 4 months, and he said it was the best drink of water he had ever had in his life. And Chaplain Capon was known to go around offering people, you know, coffee, which was really just water with who knows what inside of it. But it definitely cheered up their spirits.
There was an account I read on one of the soldiers. In fact, we did talk with him, one of the POWs, who read the 23rd Psalm with Father Capon each day. He actually had it in his possession, folks, how many years, 70 years later, and read it for us. I think you can find that on our archives back. Look under Korea on our website, veteransradio.net. That's pretty cool. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So as it turns out, that's the same guy, William Funches. And the Bible was given by the Gideons, I think, less than a month before they were captured. And he was initially in the enlisted men's compound. The guards kind of lost track of him, didn't realize he was an officer until later. And so he started the practice of reading the 23rd Psalm, you know, out of his Bible with all the enlisted men to keep their hopes up. And sometimes he would go on and read some of the gospel and other passages, but they always wanted him to read the 23rd Psalm. And he said that, you know, we asked him, how do you know that Psalm? And, it's the Lord is my shepherd. There's nothing I shall want. And it's very fitting. He said his mother always had told him to read it if he was ever in need. So eventually he gets moved over to the other camp, and, Father Capon ends up laying in the hut beside him, and William had to help take care of Father when he was sick. And but Father would often lead prayers and read, you know, out of his pocket Bible, which, yeah, again, it's amazing that he has it 70 years later and that it survived through the camp. He actually, the guards tried to confiscate it 3 times, and he said that when they weren't looking, he would always sneak it back under his foot and then bend down and pick it up when they weren't noticing. So he was able to keep it hidden.
That kind of bonding, folks, happens when soldiers and sailors and what are under that stress, and when they have somebody that can lead like that, that can overcome the chaos, overcome the suffering, and lead them into hope and not so much despair. And Father Capon's story, it spread around the world. What is that story? What does it mean, Scott?
Gosh, it's you know, it's quite amazing. Here, you know, this farm kid from middle of nowhere, Kansas. No offense to anyone in Pelton, but it's you know, his story has just spread like wildfire, and it's quite amazing to see. People just are inspired, I think, by just the fact that, I mean, you know, he did all these heroic deeds, but at the same time, a lot of the stuff that he did was very simple, you know, like offering that warm, you know, the hot water to someone to drink, or helping clean their clothes, or simply, you know, being beside them as they were digging their foxholes or the latrines. And I think that inspires people, and it's quite remarkable, though, I think, for all of us here to see how far it's spread, not only within the States, but also yeah, all over the place. We've had requests for prayer cards from the Philippines or from several places in South America, and you know, over in Europe as well. And so it's pretty exciting to see that continue to spread. And of course, he was awarded the Medal of Honor in 2013 by President Obama, and I think that you got a lot of attention and took his story even further. And so so yeah, and even recently, last month, he was recognized by the American Veterans Center in their Salute to Heroes program, which they have an in-person event and recognize many different heroes through all over, you know, many different wars. They recognized some from World War II all the way up to the most recent Medal of Honor winner, and there is a video online which goes through, you know, shares their story, and then they interview someone who knew him as well, and two of the POWs were able to be there. So it's pretty cool to still, I don't know, see that story alive and see that, you know, someone just by doing the ordinary things well and putting their spirit into it can make a difference in the world.
You know, from time to time, people think about, who should I pray to? What should I pray about? But you could, Father Capon, by calling his spirit, and going to his spirit, that has been miraculous in the past. And so that path is open right now to anybody, whether you're Catholic or what, Christian or Jewish or whatever. And that path is open because of Father Capon. He brought that sensual, that very, very, very important sensual feeling that men must have in order for them to survive. Tell us about that, Scott.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as a chaplain, chaplains are called to serve everybody, you know, and men of all faiths. And I think Father Capon really took that to heart. And, you know, he believed wholeheartedly in what the Catholic Church taught. But, you know, and at the basis of the church teaching is freedom of religion and the dignity, you know, of each human being. And sometimes that even meant the enemy, you know. He would care for them. Obviously, they had to fight them, and he wanted the men to win, but, you know, would take care of other soldiers if they were wounded as well. But yeah, he inspired men really to come together and pray. They said at times he even had non-Catholics praying the rosary, which is quite remarkable. But yeah, now that he's, you know, we believe that he's up in heaven, you know, as Catholics, we believe that the saints will always lead us to Jesus and that, God likes to work through other people. And yeah, that includes up in heaven. And so he's eager to help out, I think, in so many different ways. And, yeah, we have had, I mean, so many stories, whether it be, you know, someone's looking for a job and, you know, prays to him, some difficulties with pregnancies, that turn out well, all the way up to, you know, miraculous healings that, the doctors can't explain. And so it's, I think he's busy in heaven. I think he likes to keep busy. He was always liking to do things on earth and didn't like to sit still. So.
Well, that brings us to almost to the conclusion where we're going to now finish up here talking about Father Capon. That's Kapaun, Emil, Emil. Does he have a website?
Yeah, so the website for the Caping Guild is just fathercapon.org. You can spell out Father or you can abbreviate it FR, but yeah, FRKAPAUN, and it's .org. Unfortunately, we don't own the .com, but yeah, you can learn more. You can find a few of his writings there, and you can request some prayer cards, more information, all that sort of stuff.
Okay, we've got just a few minutes. Why don't you tell us about Father Capon is up for canonization. I mean, he's going to be a saint, and he's gone through all the stages, his story, his self. And if you could just briefly tell us, where do we stand right now in his canonization?
Yeah, so we're still at the stage where the Vatican is reviewing his life, and they look into it pretty thoroughly. It's something that obviously they you know, care a lot about, want to make sure that there's nothing slipping through the cracks. And so they're reviewing his life, and that's kind of the, if that passes, he'll be able to be named venerable. And that's sort of like our earthly, you know, this is what we can tell. He lived a holy life. At that point, they look for the miraculous, sort of the supernatural, help, guidance to say that, yes, he is up in heaven, and we do that through the miracles. And so when they review those, they have, you know, a very extensive medical board that will look at each miracle and say, did it happen because someone prayed for his intercession? And, you know, is there a medical explanation that could account for it? And, hopefully those pass, and then that's when, yeah, he can be what we call beatified, renamed blessed, and then eventually canonized, named saint. So we still have a ways to go, but things are moving along pretty well, I think.
Well, you've just about wrapped it up, but I think you I'm still going to give you last word. Scott, say something to our audience, and until the next time, go ahead.
Thanks for having me, Bob. And I, you know, obviously want to thank everybody for their service. It's an honor to be able to do this and to work with so many great people who have served our country.
It's an honor to have you, Scott. You have a blessed day.
All right. Thank you. You too.
Boy, that was really something. Wow. Father Capone. If you get a chance, folks, Google that. K-A-P-A-U-N, Emil Capone. And just look at some of those stories. And that was really moving when William Funches on our program read the 23rd Psalm that he still had folded up and dog-eared and brown and aged and whatever, and he still has that with him. Boy, that's really something. Okay, well, we're moving right along. I don't think we're going to go on a break because we're going to go on a break at the halfway point. And right now, we're going to be talking to Mary Beth Gianetti. Mary Beth Gianetti is a veteran. She served 10 years in the United States Marines. Hey, happy birthday. That's right. They had their birthday on November 10th. I got that right. Her title at the Great Lakes National Cemetery is Administrative Officer. And welcome once again to Veterans Radio, Mary Beth Gianetti from the Great Lakes National Cemetery.
Good afternoon, Bob. How are you?
Cold.
Cold, yes. I can relate. It is chilly outside.
Oh, Lord, Lord. Send me to the South, folks. Oh, no,
I know.
The older I get, the harder it is to... Oh, anyway, we don't want to get into that. Okay, the Great Lakes National Cemetery. Now, you have been with the GLNC since 2004. I didn't know that it was... it was dedicated by them. I thought it came after. Tell us about that.
Well, the dedication did come later. I was actually the third person to come on board, and that early on we were, there were just three of us, basically the director, assistant director, and myself, and we worked out of an office in Grand Blanc until the cemetery actually opened in October of 2005. We moved out to the cemetery shortly before that, and then we opened for burials on the 17th of October, 2005. So there was a little bit of prep work to do in getting ready and getting the staff trained and whatnot and all things in place so that when we did open on the 17th of October, you know, we were ready to roll because we did, there had been some delays, construction delays, with the general contractor. Some folks may remember that, but once everything got sorted out, we had a backlog of about 500 folks that had been waiting on the cemetery to open. So we were very busy, you know, from the day we opened, and it's basically continued to be a very busy cemetery. Last year, we did over 4,000 burials.
Wow.
We have been very busy.
Well, let's stop right for it. By the way, we're going to go to a break in just a few minutes. But we're going to bring you back. But let's go 4,000 in 1 year.
4,106 to be exact in fiscal year 2017. And that is every year that we've been opened, we've increased the number of burials that we've done. And last year, of course, the highest yet. So we look for that trend to continue for a few more years yet, and as more and more people get the word about our cemetery and see what a wonderful and beautiful place it is, we hope that they will, you know, at least come and take a look and think long and hard about, you know, coming to spend, you know,
sure,
eternity with us, as it were.
But let's go back to this. Let's go back to this 4,000 plus 365 days. That's more than 10 a day. Okay, somebody comes in to be buried. Do they have their own funeral director who brings in the hearse and the coffin, or is that all handled through you folks?
Well, a couple of things. You can, of course, make use of a funeral home. The trend these days that we see as far as the number of burials that we're doing and what accounts for what, we are doing well over 50% of our burials are cremated remains. So a lot of times what will happen is the families themselves are able to make the arrangements because the National Cemetery Administration has made it very easy for families to make arrangements. Some families still feel comfortable using a funeral home, and by all means, you know, if they want to do that, they're able to, particularly if it's a casket burial. In those instances, you have to use a funeral home because of the transportation of the person from the funeral home to the cemetery. But cremated remains account for, like I said, well over half of what we're doing now. So oftentimes it's the family, the next of kin in particular, that is making the arrangements, and they're bringing the loved one out there themselves with their friends and family, their loved ones.
You certainly don't do the cremation there on site, right?
No, we do not.
Okay.
We do not do that. That is correct.
Okay. So, what do we got? I'm looking at my, we got 1 minute. We got 1 minute till the news.
Wow.
So, well, why don't you give your website? We'll start with that.
Yes. The website is www.cem.va/veteransaffairs.gov, like government. And there are loads of information on that website, to include how to make burial arrangements at any national cemetery, to include ours, Great Lakes National Cemetery. And as mentioned earlier, they've made it very easy.
Families
and funeral homes.
Well, the band's got up.
No boy.
Yes, the orchestra band, the Veterans Radio. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on Talk 1600 WAAM. Don't go away. We'll be right back. I thought I'd get everybody in the spirit, because we got Black Friday coming up Friday, but we don't have Black Friday today. We have Sunshine Sunday, because it's Veterans Radio Day. And with me is Mary Beth Gianetti. She is the administrative officer of the Great Lakes National Cemetery in, right, I guess you'd say, Southeast Michigan. Okay, Mary Beth. If I am somebody and I want to be buried in the GLNC, what is the eligibility requirement?
And that's a great question, Bob. The eligibility requirement is that the veteran had to have served on active duty other than for training and been discharged under honorable conditions. So if the veteran meets those two criteria, and if the veteran happens to be married, then the spouse qualifies based on the veteran's verified military service.
Now, if somebody's spouse is going to be buried with them, correct, and they're non-military, they can do that, correct?
Right. In fact, national cemeteries are different in that sense from private cemeteries, that we do bury the veteran and spouse together, whether it's, you know, together in ground as a casket burial, or in ground cremation, or in the niches that we have available.
Well,
they will both be in the same grave site, and they will share the headstone and or the niche cover, depending on what options they choose.
Okay, now they would need them. Let's start with pre-need eligibility. What about that?
Right, that's a fairly new program within the National Cemetery Administration that allows veterans to get their eligibility established while they're still alive. It used to be, not too long ago, that they would only establish eligibility once somebody had passed away. It could be the spouse, it could be the veteran. But they have come up with a way to allow veterans to get their eligibility verified while they're still alive. That way, that removes one of the steps that they have to do once somebody passes away. The only thing left to do is really to schedule the date and time of the burial, to because verification of eligibility has already taken place. So it is, it's a very popular option at this point. They are working very hard. They have a little bit of a backlog in terms of the request, but it's, in my opinion, it's worthwhile for the veteran to pursue it. It's very easy to do. They can download the form off the website. They can call us, myself, at the cemetery. We can send them the paperwork. Very self-explanatory. And again, it's going to simplify and ease their burden. Once the family is dealing with the loss of their loved one, the less paperwork, the less administrative burden we can put on them, the better. You know, we want to make sure that we're taking care of veterans and their loved ones. That's what, you know, our mission is, to make sure that we're taking care of them. So this is one way that allows them to try to do, get involved and be a little proactive in terms of making arrangements for themselves. And it's a very simple process.
Oh, I think that's great. So they can do everything ahead of time. That is really cool. Okay.
Yes, it really is.
To wrap things up, tell us about the Wreaths Across America ceremony and when is that going to be?
I'm happy to do that. That is one of the bigger programs we have at Great Lakes National Cemetery. It's going to be held Saturday, December 16th. They will start laying the wreaths at 10 o'clock in the morning, and then at noon they will have a small ceremony at the cemetery. And, of course, it's open to the public for those people that want to help lay wreaths on the graves. You know, we're open to anybody that wants to come out and lend a hand. Most of the cemetery staff is there on hand as well participating, so it's just a great opportunity for community to come together and do something great at the cemetery. And once it's all done, the cemetery just looks fantastic. All those wreaths laid up against those white headstones, just a remarkable sight. It really is. So we invite everyone to come out and join us that day.
You're going to lay 4,000 wreaths?
Well, we're going to lay more than that. I mean, I believe there's over, as far as the upright headstones that we have, we probably have close to 25,000 or more. So depending on what gets donated through the Wreaths Across America program, that's the number that will be placed. In the past couple of years, we've had more than enough to cover all the areas of the cemetery. So it's been a terrific response from the community and the Wreaths Across America program. Couldn't do it without them, and it's just a terrific thing to do for veterans and their loved ones.
Mary Beth Giannotti, thank you very much for being on the program. We encourage everybody to go on the website, the National Great
Absolutely.
Lakes. You're right, the Great Lakes National Cemetery. Get mm-hmm. all this information, and really, folks, do this stuff ahead of time. Okay, don't wait. And the same thing with getting your DD-214. I brought that. Let me get that out. I bet you got to have that too, right?
Yep, you got to have that too. So whatever you can do ahead of time to get it, you're going to be in great shape later on. So highly recommended.
Folks, you want to go to archives.gov, www.archives.gov. Follow the prompts to get your DD-214. Oh, I don't need that. Yeah, well, you know what? Don't wait until the last minute. Get all that lined up, and we're going to have peace on earth during this Christmas holiday, and you can have peace at home. Wouldn't that be nice Christmas present for everybody, huh? Mary Beth, thank you very much for coming on the program. We're going to have you again. Is that all right?
That's great, and thank you so much. Thanks to all your listeners and the veterans. And let me just say, as a former Marine, happy birthday to all my Marines out there. Semper Fidelis!
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess you couldn't say it any better than that. In fact, well, there she goes, folks, going out to do good works. All right, let's get our third guest on the line, right? Do we have him ready? But right now, you hear throughout WHAM and Veterans Radio, the golden voice. Who is the voice? The one who introduces Veterans Radio, introduces the guest, has those golden tones. I'm going to introduce him to you live today. His name is Drake. That's all he wants to be known as, folks. He's a one name, one syllable. Drake. Drake, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thanks so much, Bob. It's a real honor to be on your program, and you do an awesome, excellent job of hosting the show. So thank you.
Too bad you don't have a good voice for the radio, you know. and you're a veteran. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, it's interesting you asked me to be on the show, and I'm a veteran in the sense that I was in the Army Reserve for 6 years active duty and 2 years individual ready reserve. But I went to basic training at Fort Knox, Kentucky.
I was there too.
Really? Yeah, that's a great place. In 1986, and, you know, it was a great experience. Everybody, for the most part, will say, oh, basic training's terrible and the food's terrible. And I really enjoyed all of it. I loved the food. I couldn't get enough of the food. And I,
what is this? Me too, Drake. Yeah. I mean, I love the chow. Gosh, I'm going, hey, I could eat this slop while I eat it.
Oh, I'd go up for thirds, you know, and you had like 10 minutes to eat. And I have a hard time keeping weight on, especially in that environment. And so, I ate every second I could, and I didn't bother to get caught talking and getting thrown out and doing push-ups if you were caught talking in the chow hall. I was eating. I was always eating
now,
as much as I could.
You're in the broadcast business. What else? Is this your full-time? This is what you do? Is there something else you do? Or is this...
This is basically it right now. So I guess, you know, one could say I'm kind of semi-retired in a certain respect.
What did you do in the Army? What was your MOS?
My MOS was journalist.
Really?
Yeah. So I wrote for the division newspaper for the 70th Training Infantry Division.
Wow. You mean somebody going in the Army or whatever can get training in journalism and do that? And...
Well, everyone goes through basic training, as you know. So I went to Fort Knox. I was there for about 9 weeks. I love the drill sergeants. I'll say again how much I love the environment, you know, and I respected the hell out of the drill sergeants. Those guys putting in 20-hour days, basically.
They
and they knew their stuff, and you could tell they were devoted and really cared. So mucho respect to those guys. And, in fact, you could get chewed out by your drill sergeant. I rarely got chewed out as an individual. I was a squad leader. I'd get punished in this group collective type thing. But you were so, you know, you could be chewed out by your drill sergeant, and they were doing their job, and you knew that. But at the same time, you respected them so much that if somebody from another platoon, even hinted at disrespect of your drill sergeants, because there was always three in your platoon, that was going to be a fight. You were going to defend the honor of your drill sergeant, even if he just chewed you out 2 seconds beforehand. Or if somebody, I was a squad leader, if somebody during training came over and insulted one of your guys in your squad, and maybe that guy was a screw-up and screwed up in that particular task, and it happened to me. Someone came over and started lecturing my guy. I got in his face, and I said, you don't ever talk to my guy that way. I talk to him that way. The drill sergeant will talk to him that way. Not you. I will beat the crap out of you right now.
Well, I'm glad that we cleared that up.
You know, so, and as you can tell, now it was over 30 years ago when I went to basic training, but those memories when you start talking about it with somebody come back like it happened yesterday.
Yeah,
it's a great experience. Everyone should go through it.
The most defining moment in our lives.
Yeah.
It wasn't. It was when he got married, though. No, when he had his six children, though, no, wasn't.
You ask any veteran, and as long as the wife ain't around, I'm sure they'll say, yeah, man, it was really great.
But I was never called up for combat. Desert Storm was going on toward the end of my 6 years. I got called to Fort Benning. I was there for about 2 weeks. I was told initially that, hey, we're all going to be retrained. This will be a ground combat war. It won't be an air war. And sure enough, they were wrong. It was more of an air war. The 100-hour ground war occurred, and then it was over, and I got sent home. So,
Drake, thank you very much.
Hey.
I'm shaking his hand now, folks. So now you met the guy behind the voice, all right, right here at Wham. And, Drake, come on back on the program again so we can talk some military stuff.
Well, thank you for having my big mouth on your show.
You
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
You got great pipes, too. All right,
thank you, sir.
We're just going to go right on through. We're not doing any break. We're going to go right through to our next guest, which is Ken Pratt. Ken Pratt is the board president of the Freedom Centers, or Freedom Centers of Michigan. Ken Pratt, he graduated from college in 1971. It was ROTC. He was commissioned a second lieutenant in the USAF Air Force, of course. He served 8 years. He was in the Philippines, West Germany after separation from active duty. He went in the National Guard and served another 21 years. He's retired now. He's a full colonel, retired as a full colonel. His civilian career was with Northwest Airlines, Delta Airlines for 27 years, retired 2014. Ken was the leading force which established the Freedom Center at Detroit Metropolitan Airport in 2011. Welcome to Veterans Radio, Ken.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to speak to all your friends around the world.
So why do we need this Freedom Center?
Well, that's a good question. And I think most GIs, both current active duty guys and veterans, are in the habit of going to a new location, particularly an airport, and expecting to find a hospitality center there. In many cases throughout the United States, that's services provided by the USO. They're a great organization. They do wonderful things all over the world. But in the case of Michigan and Detroit, they just don't happen to have a presence there.
Why do you think that? Ken, why is that? You and I talked about that before. Why do you think that? I mean, there's got to be a reason, something.
Well, I'm sure there is, and I can't speak for the USO, but my perception is that because there's no major military installation in the state of Michigan, that perhaps it has dropped off the radar as not being enough military activity there to warrant a USO.
Good
but the reality is that over the last 30, 40 years, Detroit Metro Airport has evolved into this crossroads of air transportation that on a daily basis receives and dispatches flights to all over the world, to Europe and Asia and North America and South America. And in fact, that's where our soldiers and sailors and airmen are serving these days. And as they transit Detroit, then they need a place to call their own, and that was the origin of the Freedom Center.
Now, and by the way, that's a good answer for the U.S. I don't want anybody calling them up. I don't know this. Right? No, that's a very good answer. We don't have them. But what we do have with Northwest Airlines, I don't know about Delta, you could answer that, but with Northwest, this is a hub, so we do get a lot of, I guess what you'd call planes coming in, getting ready to go somewhere else, right? Hub, tell us about that.
Yes. I was with Northwest for the better part of 20 years, and when they merged with Delta, Delta kept the hub and the international arrivals and departures in Detroit. And so in 2011, we started the Freedom Center to serve the military personnel and their families that are transiting the Detroit airport to provide them with a hospitality center.
Now, folks then, folks, when you know of a nephew, a niece, a son, daughter, whatever, you can tell them about this if they're coming through Detroit. You want to let people know about, are there other Freedom Centers throughout the United States?
As a matter of fact, no. At the present, it is a Michigan-specific activity. There's certainly the possibility that if another community were interested in copying this model, we'd be happy to share it with them. But at the present, the Freedom Center is exclusively in Michigan.
How can they get that information, Ken? Give them your website or the website for that.
Certainly. The website for the Freedom Center is very briefly MI, as in Michigan, followed by Freedom Center, all one word, mifreedomcenter.org. And that'll take you to our homepage, and it's got the information about not only what we do and how we do it, but information if one was interested in becoming a volunteer, and also how to make donations and support the Freedom Center.
I was just thinking myself of what I've got. I'm by myself, me and my cat, and so I'm thinking, what am I going to do on Christmas Day? I think I know what I'm going to be doing, folks. I think I'm going to be out there at Detroit Metro Airport. Wouldn't that be cool, ladies and gentlemen, to go out there and
just the kids, that's what they are. They're coming. Boy, they'd love to see a friendly face. They'd like to have, well, I'll tell you what, Ken, tell us about what's the hospitality center look like? I mean, what is it? Does it have rooms? Does it have beds? What is it?
Well, as a matter of fact, let me just take one step back. The Detroit Metro Airport operates two major passenger terminals, the McNamara Terminal, which is predominantly Delta Airlines traffic, is where the first and the original Freedom Center was. And the second one, which we opened a couple years ago, is in the North Terminal, which accommodates the traffic from all of the other airlines. So whatever airline you're traveling through the Detroit Metropolitan Airport, we've got a Freedom Center to greet you. And in both cases, it's about 1,000 square feet, and it's optimized for lounging. There's some very comfortable furniture there. We've got TV going. We've got free, unfettered Wi-Fi access for our guests. We've got snacks and beverages. In the McNamara Terminal, we've got a triple-deck bunk bed where you can take some serious power naps. And each facility is being served by one or more of our volunteers who are the key to any questions or problems that a veteran or his family may have. We're there to solve those problems.
Are they manned 24? Is your Freedom Center manned 24 hours?
At the present, we operate from 0600 till about 10:30 at night. And that accommodates most of the air traffic.
Sure.
When there are delays during the winter weather and summer thunderstorms and so forth, we stretch those hours to meet the needs of our guests.
Now, you called it Freedom Center, and I'd like to know, why did you call it Freedom Center?
Well, to put it into context, when we originally came up with the concept of filling this need, we had to become somebody in the sense that we weren't an entity yet. We were just a couple of guys sitting around the table with a good idea. And so the first step was to incorporate in the state of Michigan as a nonprofit so that we could legitimately collect donations and publicize our organization. And to make that as succinct as possible, we chose the title Michigan Armed Forces Hospitality Center Incorporated.
Boy, that's a mouthful.
Well, exactly. And that was about the next item of conversation at our meeting was, we can't put that on the wall as a shingle to hang out. So we cast about for a couple of ideas and, as a matter of fact, it was my good friend Pat Kolbeck, who's a state senator from Michigan, who's on our board, and he said, why don't we try Freedom Center? And we kind of tossed it around a couple of times and said, yeah, that's what it's all about. We're here to serve the guys who protect our freedom. And so now it's very iconic. We got a logo designed that is red, white, and blue, and we're in business.
The Freedom Center at Detroit Metro, it's open every single day of the year.
Yes, sir, that's right.
And I'm looking here, 6 years has welcomed more. By the way, folks, if you're going to go to the Freedom Center, or if you know somebody, they can take their dependents, too. They don't have to wait outside while you're going in there, right, Ken?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think one other important point that we need to share is that the Freedom Center is open to all veterans, not just retirees or not just active duty. Anyone who has served in the United States military is welcome to be our guest.
Wow. Well, I guess I'm going to go right to that point here, is what you said. We serve those. I'm quoting you all. This is your mission. We serve those who serve us. And I think you've expanded on that, but if you want to just say a little bit more on that, that would be okay. Go ahead.
Yes. Again, when we were devising this plan to how to serve the veterans, We thought to be right and to do this right, we need to serve all veterans. And by contrast, the USO has elected to only serve those who are currently on active duty, or if there's room, make room for retirees. But nonetheless, our vision, our mission is to serve all veterans. And so that opens the door to a lot more of the travelers that are coming through the airport. At the same time, when we reach out to the community, when we go to the USO, I'm sorry, when we go to the American Legion, when we go to the Vietnam Vets, when we go to the VFW and ask for support for the Freedom Center, and we tell them that every single one of your members is welcome the next time you come through the airport, that really opens the door, because as we have been more inclusive, then it encourages them to be more supportive of our mission.
Now, folks, you don't have to be there in your uniform, is what Ken's saying. You can, do you have to show any proof if you're in civilian clothes and you're my age? No, you can just show up, right, Ken?
Yes, we encourage people to have some form of identification, and these days it's a little bit easier with state license facilities that include veteran on your license, driver's license. If you have your 214 or if you have a VFW card or an American Legion card, that's great. A Veterans Administration card, that's fine. And even those who don't, we'll ask some pointed questions about, you know, where did you serve, or what time frame, or what regions and theaters where you were involved in. And you can tell pretty quick when somebody speaks from first-person experience about having been in the military.
Now, I'm looking here that you get a ton of money from the government, state, local, and federal. Is that right?
Absolutely none.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Independent and nonprofit.
Well, you are. So who do you get your funding from, and your food and everything? Where do you get all that from?
Well, I'm happy to say we have had great community support, and that includes, among others, some great corporate sponsors, particularly Delta Airlines has been very generous in supporting our activity. We get support from the Masco Corporation in Detroit. We get from the Meritor Corporation, several others, General Dynamics and others. We also get in-kind donations from Einstein Bagels, gives us their day-old bagels that are still good. And we get support from Costco and from several other retail outlets.
I think the best support folks that they could get is to have volunteers. If you have got some time, I can't think of anything better. As I remember being in an airport and being by myself, a long way from home, and being 18 years old. So I'm sure that as far as the support, you being a volunteer would be welcome. Tell us about that, Ken. We've got 2 minutes, so tell us about that.
Yes, and it is rewarding on every level. The volunteers that we have, some have been there the entire time, all 6 years, and you get an opportunity every time you show up there to make a difference in a veteran's life. And whether it's welcoming a World War II veteran or an 18-year-old that's just heading off to boot camp, there's an opportunity to really pay it forward to these guys. And that's why I encourage everybody to make every day a Veterans Day.
Wow, that was what I was going to ask you, but I'm still, yes, because I'm reading that here. That was cool. But I'd also like we got 1 minute. You got about 30 seconds. You get, Ken, the last word. Go ahead.
Thank you. We appreciate the support of the community, and even if you're not eligible to stop into the Freedom Center, we've got a donation box right by the front door, and every passenger that comes by there is welcome to make their statement and support us in some way.
and also folks to be a volunteer. Ken, thank you very much for being on the program. When are you going to be in Michigan next? I'd like to come out there and have lunch with you.
Well, thank you. It's been my privilege to be with you here today, and I'll be up there within the next 2 weeks.
Please call Bob. Okay, folks, you're listening to you listen to Veterans Radio. Stay tuned next week, where my partner Dale Throneberry will be back. We got lots of interesting things about. We're going to be talking about the VA. Until then, this is Bob Gould. You are dismissed.